produced by Wayne Hall, Bill Govier, Preston Frazier and Jeffrey Cresselius. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 433. What did they do next? Part 14b, Trevor Rabin.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 433 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. Please do get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. In part two of our exploration of what Trevor Rabin did next, this week Mark and I have been listening to his solo album Can't Look Away. There's plenty to like and plenty to discuss, so look out for that later on. Around the social webs this week, and starting with the Facebook, Miguel Falcao kindly shared the YMP Emporium video. As a quick update, 39 items have been bagged by 30 lucky Yes fans. That's 28 pre-order card decks and 11 full union prints. Don't forget to order yours soon because there are very limited numbers and the discount codes will all expire at midnight UK time on 31st of May. If you still need to use the special YMP code, it's YMPListener, or one word, all uppercase. If you're a YMP producer or patron, there are different codes for you. Do please tell your friends about these products and look out for a special event we're doing soon to promote them. Clearly, they make wonderful proggy gifts for birthdays, Christmas, anniversaries, lockdown parties, post-lockdown parties, and any other excuse you can think of. Anyway, back to the updates. John Anderson took part in a virtual video chat with a lot of other prog legends, and someone clipped out just his contributions, which makes an entertaining set of utterances. And Mark has an important update about his new album, which is almost ready to send out. Paul Watson shared an interview between John Kirkman and Lee Pomeroy, both interviewees here on the YMP, about Lee's work on the forthcoming Rick Wakeman prog album, The Red Planet. And in the visitor posts, Doug Curran posted his signed copy of this week's Focus, Trevor Rabin's Can't Look Away, as well as his signed 12-inch singles of Something to Hold On To and Sorrow, the latter being the rare test pressing. Jeffrey Mason's items this week included the Platform video by Dilated People, which appears to have Steve Howe's name in its lyrics. Two posts about the Squacket album, which Steve Hackett and Chris Squire released in 2012. A question for us all. Are there any recordings whatsoever of the band Gunn with John Anderson when he was with them for a short time prior to Yes in 1968? I don't know the answer to that one. Maybe you do. And finally, another post asking questions. He says, have you ever slept out overnight to get tickets to a concert? If so, what are your best memories? My favourite is spending the night at USF's Tampa campus in 1988 outside of the Sun Dome for Choice Yes official tickets for their Big Generator tour. Back then they played back-to-back shows at the same venue on January 22nd and 23rd. That's when I first learned that people recorded live shows and traded bootleg cassette tape recordings. We listened to live shows from the 1970s on someone's boombox. After that, I started trading bootlegs and became one of the many regional copiers for those Yesoteric cassettes in the early 1990s. P.S. I got front row tickets. Man, Jeffrey includes images which are low-res versions of the CD front covers he made up for the existing bootlegs from those two shows. Please do contact him via his posts if you can answer those queries. Brian Sullivan added a video of Morgan James and Doug Womble playing Owner of a Lonely Heart during their own lockdown, and it's very enjoyable with the solo female voice and the single guitar. Tony Handley drew our attention to the ongoing and completely brilliant Roger and Freya Dean live painting sessions by saying, I'm not sure if you guys saw Monday's live session by Roger Dean. If not, check out the last 5 minutes. He was talking about two new releases he will be working on with Yes. One could be the new studio album, but what about the other? He said he'll be doing 7 new paintings, including a new version of Close to the Edge, and it will also coincide with the 50th anniversary of the release of Close to the Edge. What could it be? A new Close to the Edge box set? Wow, the possibilities are tantalising. Adrian Bell's latest progressive alternative show includes Peter Banks, and many other things which sound great. And over on Twitter, Simon Barrow has joined in the Can't Look Away fun with his own excellent review on yessolidmentalgrace.com. And as always, thanks very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including the show notes commenters from last week, Dave Watkinson and Doug Curran.
I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
The first song on the album is a title track, or near enough, I Can't Look Away. Written by Rabin, producer Bob Ezrin, and Anthony Moore, who incidentally also collaborated with Pink Floyd on three of their albums, amongst other achievements, it's immediately highly reminiscent of the big guitar-based stadium rock sound Rabin achieves in parts of the 1994 Yes album Talk. The guitar soloing is huge and has a great live feel. Rabin manages to get his instrument to sound like it's telling a story, something epic and cinematic, and his keyboard lines provide a great contrast. Lou Molino's drums are just as massive as Rabin's guitar heroics, and it's an exciting opening to the record. After a 2-minute introduction, the mood settles down, and high-pitched Rabin soloing gives way to a relaxed groove to introduce the vocals, which are heavily treated to sound distant and distorted, like an old-fashioned telephone line. A full-fidelity Rabin vocal line then appears against some lovely church organ held chord backing. Again, there are more than pre-echoes of the Talk material, and the melodies and arrangements are beautifully done. The music is highly immersive in a calm way, but you know there's something approaching, and you're right. The opening guitar-driven material is back, complete with dramatic Rabin-layered harmony vocals. If you think of a more commercial-sounding and less nuanced combination of various songs on Talk, then you'll be close to this piece. Lovely touches like oscillating Hammond organ parts enhance the engrossing texture, and there's enough light and shade here to keep it interesting and not just a bang-and-bash festival. There's 7 minutes and 21 seconds of this affirmative music, which sets the scene for, well, whatever comes next. It's something to hold on to. I have to admit to being a little disappointed that this song begins with just as bombastic an approach as the previous one, if not more so. The drumming and gigantic guitar riffing is great, and there's a finely crafted bass line as well, but I would have preferred a bit of a respite after the opening number. This song is pure 80s pop rock, and as such it's fantastic. As if to reassure me, the vocals begin in a more restrained way until a classic Rabin technique of big versus small kicks in, with Molino drumming, which threatens to send plaster dust cascading from my ceiling. Backing vocals from Rabin and Duncan Four add a fine additional texture, and the softer verse bridge, which is treated in a much more poppy manner, creates an effective contrast. It's catchy and attractive music. I just hope the next song gives me some time off the arena and the Guitar Hero approach, as my head is starting to hurt. Sorrow, brackets Your Heart, is another Rabin composition with Lou Molino on drums again and a backing vocal group made up of Trevor, Duncan Four, The Passion Brokers and Bob Ezrin. Well, here we have something very different and highly refreshing. Based firmly within the musical tradition of his native South Africa, this song begins with acoustic guitars and singing by, I assume, The Passion Brokers. I can't find out a lot about this group, but their sound will surely have been familiar to a lot of listeners in 1989, following the huge global success of Paul Simon's 1986 Graceland album, which featured Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the male choral group who sing in the Zulu a cappella's vocal styles of Isicanthamaya and Mbube. And apologies for my ignorant pronunciation there. This version incorporates female singers, but the approach is very similar, at least to my Western ears. There's also some fabulous South African-sounding whizzing electric guitar which flies about. When Trevor's vocals come in with a theme, it actually all fits together rather well, not incongruous at all. The natural-sounding percussion and bass lines, which again recalls Paul Simon's own Graceland fretless bass work, is great. Interestingly, the chorus is much more like Rabin's pop-rock approach, but then we return to the former feel. The contrast is rewarding rather than cloying, and a neat a cappella moment also spices up the song. The chorus is highly infectious, and overall it's a really finely crafted song, which could have been a hit single for me, And in fact, it was indeed at least intended for release as a single, but I can only find promo and test pressing versions on CD and 12-inch. If you have an actual copy of the single, assuming it was released, do let me know. There's even a quirky synth-based epilogue to finish off a great song. Cover Up is the first song on the album to feature Alan White, sharing drum duties with Basil. Doug Curran confirms during the week that Basil is indeed a drum machine, or drum programming. So is this Alan adding his drum programming expertise into the mix rather than bashing the Skins? I'm not so sure it is. Well, they certainly do sound quite different to Lou's drumming anyway, earlier on the record, and quite reminiscent of the Union album, which Rabin and the so-called Yes West contributed to. Actually, this song sounds in feel rather like Saving My Heart from the much maligned album. Rabin's vocals are somewhat different to John Anderson, obviously, and it's quite a moody but fairly strident start to the song. Synth bass is surprisingly effective, as are the gospel choir backing chorus. There's a Giorgio Moroder-type synth ostinato in the background, and the whole thing is energetic and exciting, particularly when the gospel chorus comes in, followed up by a bit of a Trevor Horn, Art of Noise-influenced moment. Rabin's towering guitar solo almost turns into a big country bagpipe tune, perhaps as a tribute to the Scottish rockers, or perhaps not. It's a great get-up-in-the-morning-and-get-going song, and a substantial composition with all sorts of effects thrown in and plenty of memorable sing-along themes. This is one you could easily hear on the soundtrack to an 80s hit film, where the woman from a small town finally lands her dream job with the corner office in the big city. Promises is next, which interestingly has drums by the synthetic Basil again, but no mention of Alan White this time, which presumably means the programming is by Rabin. I do have the CD of this album, as I've said previously, but I'm listening to it as I write this review on YouTube, purely for convenience. And in the suggested videos list is Shoot High, Aim Low. YouTube's algorithm is working well, as Promises does indeed sound similar to the quiet parts of that song from Big Generator. Long-held synth chords are the oral bed for a baby's mutterings, and then a much more standard song groove is set up with pulsating keyboard figures. I'm almost expecting the vocals to come in with, "I only knew you for a while, I never saw your smile, till it was time to go away." Pop quiz time. That's the 1984 feel-good smash hit by Phil Oakley and Giorgio Moroder, together in Electric Dreams. Promises doesn't sound a lot like it, it's more the feel which is similar. Once it gets going, this song turns into another stadium rocker, and a rather good one at that. But there's a sudden change to a more pop ballad-like sound with some lovely Rabin vocals. The chorus returns to the grandstanding, and if you're a fan of big hair and big sounds, this is definitely one for you. I like it. The chorus is such a head-nodding, strutting workout. Promises, da-da-da, don't give me promises when all you do is lie. No promises when all I do is cry. Pure sing-along 80s US pop rock joy, and needless to say, there is a surfeit of wonderful lead guitar soloing from Trevor. Étoile Noire, Black Star or Dark Star, is a harmonically interesting layered guitar number which acts as a palate cleanser for just over a minute. It's interesting stuff. But then we are back to the dulcet tones of a rock backbeat, which could unseat marble statues from their plinths. Eyes of Love has Denny Fongheiser on drums. Fongheiser appears to have rivaled even Rick Wakeman in sheer numbers of sessions, including Disney's Lion King soundtrack, albums for Roger Waters and Peter Frampton, Freddie Mercury's The Great Pretender, and a dazzling array of others. It's another brooding, almost dirty sound, with slow drum beat and howling Rabin soloing over the top. The clouds part, however, and a lighter passage is revealed, complete with more excellent vocals. Then we're back to rock riffs and heavy drumming. The Rabin characteristic backing singer chorus against picked, arpeggiated acoustic guitar, which was to return in a different form on Talk, is attractive, but I'm finding it a little bit difficult to latch on to this song. It doesn't seem as memorable as some of the others, despite dramatic swift runs on Hammond organ and a deal of swagger. Maybe it would improve the repeated listening, and we do get a chance to hear one of those brilliant Rabin acoustic guitar solos flashing away, even if only briefly before the rock electric roars back. I Don't Think This Would Last is next. This has crisp electric guitar and Lou is back on big drums, which sounds slightly like that 80s pop band Cameo. I'm sure you know the hit, Word Up. So it's a bit of a quirky 80s pop feel with an odd repeating keyboard sound in the background. But then we hit the chorus, which is as sing-along a Rabin as you can imagine. A real crowd pleaser. You can't help nodding your head to the infectious rhythm, and the chorus, although slightly incongruous, is great fun. Stay for a couple of days, it goes. There's a long fade out, and it's a decent song. I'm just wondering if this album is a little bit too long, however. I do like Hold On To Me a lot. It's calmer and quieter, with a lovely vocal melody to begin with. The bridge is heavier, and then yet another sing-along chorus. If I was being mischievous, and I usually am, I would have encouraged Trevor to include just one of Hold On To Me and I Didn't Think It Would Last. If it was my choice, I think I'd go for the latter. They're just a little bit too interchangeable for me. More lovely, restrained acoustic soloing is a great treat here, and it's a remarkable feat to have produced this record as a solo album. It shows Rabin's amazingly diverse talents, instrumentally, vocally, as a writer and arranger, and as a producer. Sludge, however, is a 2.5 minute excursion into Rabin's mind, probably. It starts with him sipping a beverage, putting it down on the floor and then launching into a fast and furious electronic-based piece, with Lou back on drums again. It's huge fun with unison guitar and bass patterns. It's nothing like the short band member pieces on Fragile, but it reminds me of The Approach a bit. Screeching extravaganzas of lead soloing are combined with a selection of slightly mad sections, where Lou gets to express himself more freely than elsewhere on the album. The final section reminds me of Mike Keneally's solo work. It's actually one of the more interesting pieces on the record so far for me. I Miss You Now is the final full-length song on the album. The guitar and feel at the start is highly reminiscent of Where Will You Be from Yes's 1994 Talk album, and it's not any less enjoyable for that. The vocal line is very different, though. It takes a meandering path to the bridge section, which increases the tension somewhat, until the simple but effective chorus arrives. There's a gear shift to a more mobile and quicker section, which repeats the opening material in a different mood. It's an effective technique for this song, which does seem to capture the main theme of missing a loved one. Acoustic soloing is one of Rabin's trademarks, and it's just right for this song. I like this final song because it's quite different to the rabble-rousing feel of quite a few of the other pieces on the album. So, as a bit of an epilogue to the record, the final short song is called The Cape. There's a hint of the minimalist school of John Cage, Steve Reich, John Adams, etc., and its prog counterpoint, Mike Oldfield, around Tubular Bells, with the ostinato patterns at the opening of this song, which later on develop into a South African fantasy. We've mentioned The Lion King already, but here it is again, blended with Spanish guitar. Rabin packs a lot of interesting textures into this final piece of music, and it fades away, leaving the listener to consider the impact of this solo work. So, overall, I think, with a little bit of pruning, this would be an exceptional album. Just one fewer of the full-scale songs would dramatically improve it for me. I'm in awe at Trevor Rabin's musicality and prowess on a variety of different instruments, and you can clearly hear his production skills being honed here. There is the blip of Union to deal with, whatever you think of that, but the origins of Talk are abundant in Can't Look Away. Perhaps if I was going to be picky, I would have preferred more of the experimental songs and the African influences, but I need to remember that this was 1989, and the music world was different. I'm glad I've had the chance to dust off this record, and it won't be long before I give it more spins, I'm sure.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to part two of our look at Trevor Rabin on the What Did They Do Next series, as we take a further look at the album Can't Look Away. First of all, I just want to say that I hope that everybody out there is doing well and keeping safe. Over here in the Toronto area, it is a balmy 32 degrees Celsius, which is absolutely unbelievable. Not even 2 weeks ago, we actually had snow falling here, if you can believe that. Like they say here, Canada doesn't have four seasons, it has three. It has summer, winter, and fall. Spring pretty much just bypasses us. Anyways, we're not here to talk about the weather and the seasons. We're here to talk about Trevor Rabin. So, Can't Look Away. This is his fourth studio album and the first solo record he made since joining Yes. It was released on July 10th, 1989 on Elektra Records. It reached number 111 on the US Billboard 200 and stayed there for 10 weeks, which is pretty respectable. Something to Hold On To was released as a single and reached number 3 on the Billboard's mainstream chart. And there was a video for it, which I remember quite well. I'll always remember that image of him wearing those polka dot sort of outfits or shirts and the matching sort of polka dot drum set that he was playing. Sort of a weird looking drum set, if you ask me. But it's a very interesting video, to say the least. It was actually nominated as a best video at the 1990 Grammy Awards, and the album was reissued in 2011 through Voiceprint Records, which is a record label that seems to release a lot of Yes-related various Bill Bruford albums and even numerous Rick Wakeman albums being reissued through Voiceprint. So, what do I think of this record? Well, the last couple of days I've been listening to this record, and it's brought me back to a very fond memory of me listening to this when I first got it. I really enjoyed this record when it first came out. It was shortly after I had gotten Big Generator, because I had gotten that a while after it was actually released. And this came into my collection soon after that. And I really enjoyed it. I can definitely hear Trevor Rabin's contributions to Yes within this album quite a bit. And not only that, though, but I can hear the contributions of one other person on this album, and that's Mr. Bob Ezrin, who is a very well-known producer who's done everybody from Alice Cooper to Pink Floyd to Kiss to tons of people. And Bob Ezrin's always been known to be that producer that you get when you want to make a substantially impactful record, and also a record that sells considerably well. I think most albums that Bob Ezrin has touched has gone on to do some incredible record sales. Pink Floyd, The Wall is one of them. Also, the other two Floyd records without Roger Waters, Momentary Lapse of Reason and The Division Bell, are both records that did astonishingly well under Bob Ezrin's tutelage. And the reason why I'm bringing up those records is because not only does he have Bob Ezrin involved as far as engineering production, and he even appears on some backing vocals in some songs, he also brought with him somebody who he had used on some of the Pink Floyd records, and that's a songwriter named Anthony Moore. Now, Anthony Moore worked on a few songs for Pink Floyd, and I believe it was for the Momentary Lapse of Reason album. I believe it might have been on the Turning Away, and maybe even Learning to Fly, and another couple of songs. I can't recall offhand, but I know that his name is all over that record. And if you listen to a lot of the production on this album, the guitars have a very, very David Gilmour-ish sort of sound to them. Very delayed and very heavily reverbed, very soaring kind of solo sounds, especially on the opening track, I Can't Look Away. It's so Pink Floyd-ish in the production of his vocals and the production of the music itself, the guitars, everything. And again, that was written as well with Anthony Moore. So it's very interesting how the inclusion of some people can take music that is done by an individual and shape it into something that we can remember other bands doing as well. Now, that's not to say that this whole album is nothing but a Pink Floyd, I'm not going to say ripoff, but a tip of the hat to, but it is interesting because Momentary Lapse of Reason came out in 87 and this record came out in 89. So obviously the influence of that record would have been pretty big. It was a big chart topper at that time. So let's talk about some of the other songs. The next song, Something to Hold On To, was completely written by Trevor Rabin, but again, you know, has elements of this production in it. But this song, though, has a little bit more Yes leanings to it. The guitar sound is a little bit more jangly. It reminds me more of some of the stuff from Big Generator. In fact, it reminds me very much of Love Will Find a Way, this song. And I think I mentioned that on the last episode we did when we talked about this record. And again, if we're talking about factors that affect records, one of the things that are also very evident on here is some of the guest musicians. For example, we have our friend of the podcast, Lou Molino III on drums, who has played on the first three tracks, which are I Can't Look Away, Something to Hold On To, and Sorrow. And he's also credited for drums on I Didn't Think It Would Last and Sludge, the instrumental. Then we also have drums from somebody that we are all very familiar with, and that is Mr. Alan White of Yes, who plays on Cover Up, and he also plays on I Miss You Now. So having such strong drummers on here obviously help as well. I mean, Lou Molino is such a fantastic drummer. And ARW, he really showed his skill in full flight there when he was playing with them. And obviously, he's a great drummer. He's been following, I guess, Trevor through his solo stuff of late. I believe he's on Jacaranda as well, his later solo record. And there's also a credit to somebody named Basil. And like I predicted in the last episode, Basil is in fact a drum machine. And he is credited, he is credited to be on tracks 4, Cover Up, tracks 5, Promises, and also Mr. Basil appears on Hold On To Me and I Miss You Now as well. Which is interesting because Alan White is credited to drum on that as well. So most likely Basil, quote unquote, is probably there for maybe some percussive stuff like, some sort of looping drum beat, something that you would maybe hear like Phil Collins have, put in for one of his songs. In fact, if my memory serves me correctly, there is a sort of drum loop at the beginning of I Miss You Now, like a kind of do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That sounds like it's like, wood blocks, another kind of program percussion in there. So that would be probably Basil's contribution to this song. And then we have Alan White with his sort of, Alan White-ish sort of powerful drumming for the rest of the track. Again, technology being used, this is not something that's unfamiliar to Mr. Ezrin, as he has done very much similar stuff on other albums, for example, the Pink Floyd records that we talked about. Now, what's interesting to also make note of is when we talk about the song Cover Up, for example, which is the other song that Alan White drummed on, when you listen to the drums on that song, it's very much of a sort of gated 80s drum sound. Like the snare drum is very, has that gated reverb sound, like that do-do-do-do-do-do sound to it. And that's very popular back in the 80s. I think Phil Collins is one of those people who also kind of started that whole sort of fad of doing it. And of course, being that it was a popular drum sound then, producers like Bob Ezrin would have jumped all over it. Now, that drum sound was also present on 90125, although not as strongly. I found that Trevor Horn's version of the drum kit was a little drier, and which was much more better, I think, for the songs that were on that record. But on Big Generator, I found that some of the drums were a little bit more massive sounding and had some of that sort of sound in it as well. So it's obviously a sound that Alan White probably liked as well. It is a sound that's obviously on Big Generator as well. So I think that maybe as a sort of a compliment to Alan, I think maybe Bob might have just included that sort of a drum sound in for him to maybe just give him some sort of identity on the song. I mean, if you take a listen to Something to Hold On To, that drum set sound is similar, but again, it's not as large. It's a little bit more dry. The kick drum is not nearly as present as Alan White's sound when he plays drums on this record, which is interesting. Either he has a heavier kick foot, or maybe he just was mixed lower, Lou Molino I'm talking about, in these songs. Something to Hold On To, every time I listen to that song, it just boggles me that it wasn't on Big Generator. Mind you, he could have written it long after the record was done, but I have a feeling that Trevor had a lot of these songs in his back pocket for a long time. So I'm wondering if this was one of them. I'd love to get Trevor on the podcast and talk to him about this, but I know that he's one of these elusive characters that's very hard to get on to a podcast to talk about things. But if we ever did, that would be the first question I'd ask him, is if he actually had this song written before they even did Big Generator. Anyways, the rest of this album is extremely strong. There's a lot of fantastic showing of his guitar playing. His vocals are front and center, which is not a surprise because, number one, he's a great singer. Number two, Bob Ezrin has always been one of these guys that's put vocals front and center and made them the focal point of most records. Now, of course, he also likes making guitars a focal point on his records that he produces as well. And he does that in spades here as well. I think this is easily one of Trevor Rabin's best performances on a record, even including Yes, in my opinion. I think overall, having listened to this record quite a bit, while it has his own stamp on it, there is a lot of Ezrin on here. There is a lot of Pink Floydish sort of stuff going on in here. So is that wrong? No, I don't think so. I think they wanted to make a popular record, a good selling record, and it did do very well for him. I think it's probably his best selling solo album, hands down. And as was mentioned in the first episode on this record, it was so popular, in fact, the single, that the record labels were kind of concerned that maybe it would be competing directly with ABWH. So, yeah, obviously they thought very highly of this music and pushed it quite a bit for radio. And again, like I said, Bob Ezrin has always been one who wants to make a record stand up and shine, mainly because he wants to help out the artists, but also because, hey, let's not kid ourselves. He gets production credit, he gets the production royalties from it, so that lines his pockets very nicely if a record does well. So I'm going to leave the rest of the songs and analysis to Kevin, who does a very excellent job every time we do something like this and goes through each song bit by bit, but I thought I'd give my perspective on this from a sort of musician slash producer, engineer, mixer kind of guy. And I think I brought up some interesting points. So I'm sure we're going to talk about this further with Kevin. So let's go do that now.
Trevor Rabin, Don't Look Away. And for a discussion now, Mark is with me. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. It's nice and hot here in the UK. Lovely summer days we're having, even though it's not officially summer yet, but still on lockdown. How about you?
It's pretty warm here too. Not as bad as yesterday, but you know, still pretty warm. Summer has arrived.
Excellent. Okay, so Trevor Rabin then, and I really enjoyed listening to this record a lot more than I did previously. I don't think I was paying attention when I listened to this some time ago when I got the CD. I certainly enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. And it's fascinating, isn't it, from the point of view of Trevor Rabin's development. And I was thinking about what you said about Bob Ezrin and how much as a musician and as a producer and as an arranger that Trevor Rabin must have learned from him. And also, of course, he's just come from working with Trevor Horn on 90125, and then all sorts of different things happened on Big Generator, which we won't go into at the moment. But can you see, I mean, you probably know Trevor Rabin's solo output a lot better than I do. So can you very much see this as a development point, maybe a turning point for Rabin in his production, in his arrangement, etc.?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it's very obvious to me that this is like a grandiose step forward for him. I mean, not that his records were bad before or nothing, but like I said before, once you have Bob Ezrin involved with your stuff, you're doing it for a few reasons. One, you want to get a big record. And you want to have a record that sells, and he knows how to make albums that sell, as we know with Pink Floyd and with Alice Cooper and various other acts that he's worked with over the years. They've all had big sellers when he was involved, and he definitely has a sound involved to it. Like the more I listen to this album, and I've listened to it at least twice a day for at least 5 days now, it's just incredible to me how much I can hear Momentary Lapse of Reason on this record.
Yes, well, that's an era of Pink Floyd that I don't know a huge amount about, and I haven't listened to all those records from that time. But that is fascinating, isn't it? And you think that's a link between Rabin via Anthony Moore then, because I know he worked actually around this time, didn't he, with Pink Floyd?
Well, I think it has a bit to do with it, because Anthony Moore is, I think, more had to do contributing lyrical-wise than he did music-wise.
Yeah, okay.
But the addition of Bob Ezrin is definitely where the Floyd thing comes from, because that huge sound that he has for the drums, and especially his guitar solo tones, and the way he affects his voice, like how he did that sort of, as you call it, the radio voice, kind of transmitted radio voice, that kind of stuff is all over that Floyd record, where they kind of drop it down and they use that sort of an effect on there. And but it's very, I mean, I'll put it to you this way. Do yourself a favor later when you have time.
Yeah.
Just download a couple songs from Momentary Lapse of Reason, like Dogs of War and stuff like that, and listen to it, and you'll be in shock how similar you'll hear stuff on there.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating. So I did hear, as you did, a lot of Big Generator Union bits, and particularly Talk. And if you ignore Union in the Middle there, which was very, very different whole project, then this does seem like a very important stepping stone on the way to Talk from 90125, from Big Generator. And that you can really understand Rabin's influence. I mean, we've said many times before that in Talk, Rabin is the principal influence on that record, because he did all the production, he did a lot of the writing along with John Anderson and so on, but But yeah, the approaches, and I think once you get those other members of the Yes group involved, I think they really honed this sound that he was coming up with on this record, however much it's got to do with Pink Floyd. He certainly was developing his own techniques and so on, and when you get to Talk, that seems to have come to a high point there. So it very much did, as I said before, feel like that progression to Talk for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm not making it sound like it's an utter rip-off. It's not. I think it's more just how the times were, what was popular at that time for the sounds, he was right on it. But obviously there's a lot of Trevor Rabin on this record too. Like you said, yeah, he one of his trademarks is doing guitar solos that are, you know, either doubled or done on acoustic guitar or classical guitar. Yeah. That's all over this record.
Yeah,
his solo style is very evident. His singing is very much Trevor Rabin. It's not David Gilmour. And so there's a lot of him on there. And as you said, as time goes on, you know, this record I think was important because he probably learned a lot of production tricks and tried different things that maybe he wouldn't have tried earlier.
Yeah.
And that all led to what we got on Talk. Now, don't forget, Talk was looked at as a very sonically advanced record.
Yes.
You know, back at that time, to do a digital record like how he did was unheard of. I mean, Alan White even said that it was incredible. They had like tons of hard drives in this shed, and they had to have big fans blowing on it because they would overheat and stuff. So it wasn't an easy record to make. But, you know, I think what he learned from this period was like to take some chances and try stuff that maybe hasn't been done, because that's what's going to make your stuff kind of stand out at the time.
Yeah, I suppose one of the things which didn't come through as much on records like Talk were the South African influences. Now, clearly I mentioned in my piece that some of it did remind me very much of Graceland, where Paul Simon did work with musicians from South Africa. And clearly, Trevor's background being in South Africa, it was great to hear that. And I think where he did do that, it worked extremely well. And those gospel elements which he brought in as well. And some of them, those very short pieces, were quite left field, weren't they, some of those? There was quite a lot going on that wasn't going on in the rest of the album. So you've got a mix of big 80s hit type records, stadium rock and all that stuff that Trevor Rabin is fantastic at. But there are also hints of some very different types of techniques and approaches in there.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, when I was reading it, I had a smile on my your review when I was reading it, I had a smile on my face because I thought you absolutely nailed that whole, was it Lady Blacksmith Mombasa, that group that they used in Paul Simon.
Yeah.
It's absolutely sounds identical to it. I mean, I have a fantastic DVD of the making of Graceland.
Oh, right? Yes, I think I've seen that,
and,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really great the way it was done. And they had those guys that are involved in that African group on there talking about how they worked with Paul Simon. And you could, it just has that sound, doesn't it, when they start singing. And it's all over that song, Sorrow. Like, you can, it's at the beginning it starts that way. And at first, when you really think about it, it is extremely Paul Simon sounding with the acoustic guitar and the way that they were singing. It's interesting how he starts to unify these different popular sounds of the time. Because, I mean, Graceland was a huge seller. Like, 14 million sales, I think, it had that album. Yes. So, I mean, you can't help but to think that Bob Ezrin was thinking to himself, okay, I know a few ways to get some records sold. Maybe if we incorporate this, and it's not out of left field totally, because, you know, Trevor Rabin, as you said, is from South Africa.
Yes.
So to say that that's his influence would not be a stretch.
Not at all, no. So, you know, he must have, although he's not obviously from the black townships or anything himself, that music was obviously all around him when he was growing up in South Africa, even though he took a very different turn with Rabbit, who were not quite that sound, that's for sure. Much more of a rock outfit, of course. And I was thinking about this, very much a solo record. So, you know, he plays most of it himself and sings most of it and wrote or co-wrote most of it, but was able to choose exactly the right collaborators. And that's not always the case, is it, in solo records? Sometimes, even in the Yes members that we've talked about, they've teamed up with people who haven't been haven't been brilliant, but certainly he's got the right collaborators here, and someone like Lou Molino, you can hear even in this record the bond which then, as you said, came to fruition in ARW. And I did love the interplay between Lou and Lee Pomeroy and Trevor Rabin when I went to see ARW, and of course getting Alan White in there. So he's really chosen well, hasn't he, for his collaborators?
Yeah, absolutely. He's done a fantastic job with that. I mean, Lou Molino is a home run, no matter how you look at it. I mean, his drumming is fantastic on this record. And having Alan in there, you know, that's like a no-brainer in my opinion, having him on there. He was so good at this time period as well. I mean, not that Alan ever was bad, but, no, you know, he was at, yeah, I think he was at a second peak at this point as far as his drumming went. But yeah, I mean, he had all kinds of fantastic people working with him. I mean, even the songwriters. I mean, like I said, Anthony Moore, he's a good lyricist, and the songs that he did contribute to, like Cover Up and I Can't Look Away, are obviously good contributions on his end, you know? And what I was actually kind of surprised about, to be quite honest with you, is knowing how Mr. Ezrin works, having a lot of the records that he's done, he likes to get involved in the writing of it to the point of where if you look at the song credits, it's usually Ezrin, 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 Ezrin on every song, right? But on this album, he's not nearly as credited. I mean, he's on Can't Look Away. He's credited on Eyes of Love. He's credited on I Didn't Think It Would Last. And that's about it. And the rest of it is Trevor Rabin with maybe a couple of other people. You know, Anthony Moore on a couple of songs. And another gentleman named Patrick Van Blerk on one song.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And that's it.
So, very much a solo record, that's for sure. But just going back to Alan White's drumming here and the famous Basil, the drum machine. so fascinating to hear that. And I don't know if Alan White was involved with the programming to enhance what he was doing on particular songs there. But again, I can't help thinking of Talk and some of that Alan White drumming and the way that it's got some kind of technology or effects or whatever it is applied to it. Certainly that's the basis for the Talk drum sound, and that's something which Trevor Rabin certainly learned from these sessions, it sounds like to me, and maybe picking up tricks from Bob Ezrin and so on. So, you could play these songs back to back, the Talk songs and these songs where Alan White is involved, and you know, that's definitely the Talk drum sound for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that in some of these songs like Cover Up, where he does play, I think that, you know, it's mainly Alan drumming, I think, in those songs. Yeah. And I think that that Basil is there to just kind of, you know, add a little bit more, you know, texture to it in other ways. Maybe he's just filling in some things with little loops and stuff like that in there as well. And don't forget, sometimes they use these drum machines to, you know, beef up, you know, snare drum sounds and stuff like that too, right?
Yeah. I'm sure that's absolutely right. And yes, it's definitely Alan White's drums. It's not Alan White's drums and programming or Alan White drums and percussion or anything like that. It's definitely him with his drum kit, I think, very much. And I liked your point about how the vocals were a focal point sort of alongside the guitar. So, of course, you think of Trevor Rabin as a guitarist, but we know he also is a fantastic keyboard player and a wonderful singer as well. And I agree with you. I mean, if you think about the times he's singing on 90125, on Big Generator, on Talk, these vocal performances, I think, are far better than quite a few of those other ones where he's not center stage. Obviously he's center stage here. He is the vocalist on this record, but an absolutely towering vocal performance, I thought.
I agree 100%. I mean, that's one of the things that now, having listened to it again after a few years of not listening to it, that really impressed me was how strong a singer Trevor is, and especially on here. And again, a lot of people sometimes, you know, especially when I meet younger musicians and say, well, you know, why do I need a producer? You know, why do I need to have somebody come in and tell me what to do? Well, they're not necessarily there to tell you what to do, but they're sometimes there to give you some motivation, you know, like, that was good, but let's try it a little bit higher, or try it a little bit more raspier tone. And I think that Trevor Rabin got some really good guidance vocally on this album from Bob Ezrin. I think that a lot of the harmonies are fantastic. A lot of the kind of ways he approached the melodies are brilliant. And, you know, he has a lot of that in him himself, as we could tell later when he did Talk and stuff like that. So it's not like he needed somebody to totally steer the ship, but I think that he just helped him refine his vocals on this album and made it just that much more stellar sounding.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Now, the only sort of downside for me was, that, as I said in my piece, it's slightly too long for me. Is it, do you know, a long album?
Well, look, overall, it's a 55-minute album.
Right, okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, to me, that's long, especially for vinyl. You should be cutting it off around 45, 48 minutes if you want to get optimally the right sort of, you know, sonic sounds from your vinyl record. I mean, everybody will tell you that. That's not just me saying that. That's tons of engineers I've worked with, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And, you know, I have that, you know, white label promo pressing of it. And, you know, the Dead Wax area is pretty small on it because they had to squeeze in a lot of stuff into this record, especially if they wanted to make it sound good, right? Yeah. So for me, I don't disagree with you at all. I think that they could have afforded to maybe drop off a couple of songs on here and made it more of a 40, in the 40s, 47, 48 minutes. You know, I think they could have maybe, as much as I liked everything on this record, I think they could have maybe gotten away with taking off, you know, Etoile Noir, or maybe taking Sludge off, or even Cape. I mean, they have three instrumental tracks on here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If they would have took off two of them, that's almost 5 minutes off the record.
It's true, yes. I mean, I've already said in my piece that if it had been up to me, I would have lost one of the big numbers. And it's just, and the way it's put together as well, I was very pleasantly surprised, because my recollection of listening to this CD the first, just after I got it, was that every, you know, it was relentless. Every song was a big, crowd-pleasing arena song. But that's not true. But I did think there were just one too many of those, although I do love the way that they're done. They're absolutely brilliantly done. Do you know anything of the live performances of this material?
No, actually, I don't. I mean, I know that there's a live album of it out there, and that's one thing I was going to look into next, is to hear it, because I am curious, but I don't know very much about that at all.
No, okay. Well, if you're listening and you've heard that live album and like it, do tell us all about it, because fascinated to hear who's on it. I mean, I'm assuming Lou Molino plays on it, but although Trevor played all the instruments on the record, there's no way he could do that live, even with a bit of programming and sequencing and so on. So fascinating to hear these songs live as well. That would be wonderful. Okay, but don't take don't take our word for this. Have your say on the show notes, please. What do you think of this album? I'm very, very pleasantly surprised myself. I'm looking forward to listening to it again. But for the moment, thank you very much, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Just before we go, here's the Patreon update, or half of it. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kjellberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Sarkhol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington and William Hayes. As always, continued thanks to Robert and David. Thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in keeping the lights on at YMP Towers here, then please go over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for the details, or just click on the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please do keep following and interacting with the show. via Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.